KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Little merry-go-round music here at 94.9 KUOW Seattle. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Our Journalist Roundtable is coming up, but we're having so much fun with Stan and Hunter Freeburg that we just forgot about the weather. No, we didn't forget about it, Nick Bond, but we held you over. So here is Washington State climatologist Nick Bond, who is going to assure us that tomorrow will be sunny, right?
Right, yes, and good morning. It's definitely a better day than yesterday. It rained about as much as it can around here this time of year, and there are places in North King County an inch or almost an inch and a half. Today, plenty of clouds, but we're getting some breaks between them, so mid to upper 60s seems to be where we're headed. And tomorrow, yeah, great forecast. Everybody involved in tomorrow's marathon should be pleased.
That's the rock and roll marathon tomorrow?
Yeah, so just kind of high 50s at the start, maybe low to mid 60s at the end of the race, plenty of clouds, but then warming up in the afternoon to the mid and upper 70s so you can, you know, kind of those muscles, sore muscles can get some relief.
But that weather is only like sort of a one-day sun appearance?
Well, Sunday, it's a little trickier. I think it'll still be a pretty reasonable day. There is a system moving into our south, but it looks like right now that the rain's going to hold off until Sunday night, and there may be some mid and upper level clouds, but it should still get into the mid, maybe even upper 70s on Sunday, so not so bad. But then another shot of rain Sunday night and again Tuesday afternoon or night. But then again, a gradual improvement by the end of the week.
Well, one thing I was interested to see is that that NOAA's Climate Prediction Center says we're going to see a drier than normal summer. So this isn't actually starting off to look like that.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's still for the month of June, we're below normal.
Are we?
Here. Yes,
so we got
are.
It all in one day is what you're
saying. Yeah, that's right. And it was concentrated especially in North King County and South Snohomish County. So it's, that's still the expectation that July and the summer as a whole will be drier than normal. And especially in eastern Washington, but even on the west side, that'll also be warmer than normal too. And so, you know, I think people will be pleased with that forecast.
Okay. Are those usually accurate?
Well, yeah, more accurate than not. And we don't actually use chicken entrails for that purpose.
Oh, what are you doing, casting stones? How do you do it over there?
The tea leaves, right?
Tea leaves.
There are a variety of tools that are employed. And we use these very sophisticated climate models that are run various centers around the world, and basically the same ones that are used to make climate change projections. And then we use statistics, kind of basically expecting the history to repeat itself in terms of the weather. Both the models and those kind of statistical methods can account for things like El Nino and La Nina and so forth. And then finally, we also use kind of recent trends. And the idea here is that if the last decade of summers, let's say, has been on the dry side, then that will tend to persist, we've found, even if we don't fully understand why that is.
Well, I will trust you because I'd really like to get out those sleeveless shirts. But until then, I'll just wear it tomorrow because I know tomorrow is going to be nice. Yeah. And I know you guys are really accurate 24 hours ahead, right?
Well, we're pretty good there, you know, not 100% accurate, but I think the chances of any rain tomorrow are so minimal that don't have to worry about it.
Okay, well, thank you. Nick Bond, Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He's with us normally just before 10 o'clock, but this week a little special. We've moved everything around here, so thanks for the forecast. And I guess we're just going to go right in from one forecast to the next. The state revenue forecast had some good news for lawmakers who have seemingly been in Olympia for months and months without doing a whole lot. And joining us, as they do each Friday, Joni Balter, assistant political editor at Seattle Times, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, and Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. Tax receipts up, legislators gone.
Not quite gone. Not gone enough, shall we say.
They keep saying that they're making progress.
Well, it does sound like they are, and $320 million in found either revenue or lower caseload costs. We'll do that from. I feel like I've seen this movie before where the legislature's completely locked. This actually hasn't happened for a while that they've been saved by new money because the recession was always about one, you know, worse. A bad forecast after the next, but this time, and this has happened many a time when the legislature's locked up, money appears from a different revenue forecast, and all of a sudden everybody's big buddies, everything's going well. Hey, we can get out of here by Sunday, which is what many of them have said. The significance, of course, of Sunday is that Monday, some layoff notices are expected to go out just in case they don't do what they're supposed to do. And the July 1st deadline comes around, and we are in some kind of partial shutdown where 34 state agencies would be affected. Some would be closed. Some would be partially. It would be ugly. That would be one way to phrase it.
We're not going to see that, I don't think.
Oh, no.
But what happened to all the posturing of, you know, 10 days ago where, you know, we're not going to do this unless you do that, and suddenly $200 million appears and all of that's forgotten?
Well, I don't know that it's forgotten, but what happens is they just say, hey, we can't get there.
And it's the proximity to a deadline. The posturing gets, you know, more puffed up the closer you get to about a week out from the deadline, and then everyone starts unpuffing themselves and coming together.
Well, maybe we should just make the deadline sooner.
I agree.
Well, then the controversy would just move back, too.
Oh, so we That's not... So, I mean, it's almost too much. But, I mean, either way, I suppose everybody's glad that we're going to have a budget, and it's good news if there's $200 million more than there were expected to be. But the governor still says that there's more of a gap than $200 million.
Well, right. Yeah, I mean, the $200 million doesn't begin to bridge the gap between the House Democrats and the, I mean, it's better than, as Joni pointed out, it's better than the kinds of reports they've been getting in past years, which has always gone the other way.
Yeah, that's true.
And often even with larger increments.
Absolutely.
You know? So it's undoubtedly good news, but it's not a solution. And so everything comes to a focal point. Deadline regarding the shutdown and the necessity of having a budget. People are, you know, as part of a compromise, some people are going to have to let go of their pet bills or whatever that they were insisting get passed in order. I think everybody probably recognizes, most everybody, that a shutdown would be a huge black eye with some real negative consequences. And nobody wants to get tagged with that. Nobody wants that black eye to be the cause of it. So we'll see. Everybody's sort of sharpening their pencils. As I said last week, you know, I think the unfortunate thing is that the budget that will pass will still be inadequate, right? Whatever it is.
There will still be a lot of cuts to social services. But to your question of can't we just speed up the deadline, I actually think the governor has very effectively done that by raising so forcefully the specter of a shutdown. We haven't heard that done in quite this way in recent previous years, at least to my memory. And, you know, the legislative session, as I understand, is not over on Monday. But the fact of these notices going out kind of makes a new deadline that's closer than the actual final deadline and focuses people a little bit more. And so hopefully moves this along more quickly.
In the Seattle Times last weekend, there was an article about how nothing had gotten passed in the first extra session, and lawmakers were still submitting their per diem, not all of them, but some of them, and so it was costing taxpayers money. Somebody came up to me and said, well, I don't think they should get paid if they don't do anything.
Does that apply to Congress as well?
That they might say the same thing. We could talk about the farm bill now if you want to talk about
it. I heard your interview on the farm bill. You know, I wondered as I was listening to Jay Inslee talk about, you know, this is what a shutdown would look like. who do all these folks who work in Olympia think was going to be blamed? It would be all of them. It wasn't, you know, when I listened to each side talk about it, I kept thinking, so you think the other guys are going to be blamed? You're all going to be blamed. That's how that works.
Maybe a sliding scale on the per diem where the amount that they get to spend on lunch gets less and less the longer they stay.
I know we don't pay our state lawmakers a tremendous amount of money. We do, however, pay our congresspeople a whole heck of a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, shouldn't there be productivity tied? I'm just throwing this out there.
These are like performance-based. This is like some of what they're debating.
Right.
Where they want some performance-based
right.
outcomes for,
right.
for like, an education.
What's good
but,
for the goose
but
is good for the
that
gander.
But it has applied to the legislative
but,
branch.
But measuring that would be very difficult because in some cases, success is not having laws passed.
I suppose it depends
many,
what
many
side of.
There are cases where we do not want the legislation to pass. So I don't think, yeah, giving them an incentive just to pass laws would be a good idea.
How do you judge their effectiveness? Any law, I mean, on the local level, state level, national level? I'm just wondering. I mean, we elect these people, so is the recourse then that we vote them out of office if they don't get their jobs done?
Well, it's tricky for us because the people that we vote, at least we in the Puget Sound area, are by and large doing a good job of representing our interests. Mm-hmm. It's just that they're outvoted in Olympia by people who have opposing interests. So it's actually very hard for us to hold the right people accountable, legislatively speaking.
And, you know, polls show that, and this is really interesting, that if you ask people about their individual representative, they like that person. They tend to, because they voted for them, for one thing, mm-hmm. and they follow them a little bit, and they like them. But when you get to the big institution, Congress, legislature, that's where the numbers go down. That's where people go, you know, I like my individual rep, but I don't like the what happens when they get together as a group. That isn't as pretty.
Are you saying that you don't like the democratic process when you say
well,
that?
Yeah, that's part of the downside of it. But it's also a matter of political changes in the political process that have occurred. And these things have happened, I think, cyclically in American history. And we're going through a period now where congressional districts and to some degree our legislative districts are being drawn very ideologically. And so that blue districts are really blue, red districts are really red, and there's very little in between. There's a very narrow band of districts. Washington really only has one district now that's considered a true swing district. And that could go either way. That's 50-50 Republican and Democrat. So one of the things that's happening is that everybody's happy with their representative, but there aren't those as many of those people sort of in the middle that can slide either way and survive politically. Of course, there's good side and downside to those people. Rodney Tom, some people think that he did a good thing by joining with the Republicans. Other people think he did a terrible thing by doing that. But there are not many people in that position anymore. And so it's part of it has to do with hyper-partisanization
That's a
of
good word.
Congress and
$27 word right there.
Eli?
Talking about who may be held accountable for this legislative session, I think Rodney Tom is someone who may be held accountable not just by his district, but by people outside of his district who are in liberal districts who are mad at him for defecting essentially to the Republican Party for this session and stymieing the Democratic agenda and slowing things down.
We're talking over the week's news and then speculating out into the future. It must be something about Stan Freberg that has my mind wandering into the stratosphere. Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knute Berger, I'm Marcy Silman. We'll be back after a break here on KUOW Seattle.
Dunkin' Donuts has a plan. Special drinks, comfy chairs, free Wi-Fi. Wait, hasn't this been done before?
You can get on their website and buy a t-shirt that says, Friends, don't let friends drink Starbucks.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Dunkin' Donuts, Starbucks, and roasting the competition. That and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APM.
That's tonight at 6:30 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms and More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, providing a selection of two-sided flippable mattresses designed for lasting comfort. Learn more about flippable mattresses at bedroomsandmore.com.
56 degrees in Seattle. We expect to reach 65 this afternoon with clouds and a chance of showers. It's 1021. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Flooding in Alberta, Canada has forced 75,000 people from their homes. More about that in the news at 11.
This is KUOW's Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. We're talking over the week's news with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. Ed emails, we're talking about Congress. Don't forget, they vote for and control their own pay, and it's for life. Those are caps. It's not just while they're in office. Is that true?
Wow. I think they keep some benefits. I don't think they keep
they don't
salaries.
Keep the salary.
They have, I mean, there's some pretty generous pensions.
Maybe I should run for Congress.
Benefits. I've always thought that there should be some law that requires Congress to live by the minimum wage and health care availability that average citizens. In other words, that they don't get excused from the sort of averages of the people that they're governing.
This has actually been a little bit of an under-the-radar controversy with so-called Obamacare, where Congress was going to be living under Obamacare, and there was a move afoot in Congress to move them off of President Obama's health care plan because they wanted better benefits, and that kind of faded away very quickly.
Ouch.
There's a popular notion.
We were talking just before we took the break about the one district out of 10 that is a mix of red and blue. It's the first district?
It's the first district, the seat currently held by Susan DelBene. And when they drew that district, remember that we had the recent redistricting commission. I remember Slade Gorton coming to the phone to discuss that district. And I think he said it's 49.3% Democrat, or might have been Republican, but same diff. And so it was very close. She, of course, won. But what I've noticed in the email already is there are already, she's been in office, you know, 5-6 months or something like that, and there are already sort of day-by-day attacks on positions she's taking.
I can't remember how it worked because she was filling a seat and
there were two elections is what you're referring to.
Right.
So she had to fill for Jay Inslee in the district that as it had been
old first district.
She's in the new first district.
And then she won the election.
She won both, so she went there a little earlier, actually.
Well, and it was really interesting because he had two of the most brilliant minds in the state, Slade Gorton on the Republican side and Tim Cease on the Democratic side, drawing that district. I mean, essentially coming down to how and looking, you know, almost household by household, how people vote. And one of the things that was observed was that the first district had a history, when you looked at all those precincts, had a history of tending to vote Democrat in presidential election years and voting Republican in off years. Hmm. Well, the Democrats won in a presidential election year.
There it is.
And so Susan DelBene's chief vulnerability will be her first reelection to the seat. So she's got 2 years to solidify, and they have 2 years to get back on that Republican trend line.
And did you happen to notice that she, being, you know, one of the few females in the delegation, came out this week about and you know, had quite a showing about the abortion bill that passed the House. She got a lot of attention this week, but she asked for it.
Well, I just find it interesting. I was reading in the New York Times this morning about the farm bill in the House and then the Senate trying to hammer out some kind of compromise so that they can move ahead with immigration reform. The gist of the article was that it's easier to hammer out compromises in the smaller body than it is in the House of Representatives. And it's partly because of the way they draw the districts that they are, I mean, maybe not every state has two great political minds at work when they're examining them, but that some of the districts are ideologically entrenched in particular viewpoints.
Well, the drawing of those districts varies from state to state in terms of who does it and how they do it, whether courts do it or commissions and bipartisan, or is it party emphasis. So, yeah, there's a lot. We have a system where you have kind of representatives of both parties, but they have to get a majority. So they have to get someone from the other side to agree. So it requires almost a consensus.
And also a lot of horse trading. Remember, they went well to the deadline. The deadline was New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And I had this image of them sitting there, you know, with the champagne over here and the maps over here and trying to figure out what we're going to do with this last district.
Well, and that's one reason that Dave Reichert of Bellevue is also representing Lake Chelan.
Where he has a summer home.
Yeah.
where he does. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's
there
fine.
You go.
So that's
they
how
probably
the eighth now has a long
summer.
Tail. It goes. The eighth goes.
Yeah, jumps the Cascades.
But that used to be a more swing of a district, potentially swing of a district, and it's not so much anymore.
We're talking over the week's news, and I find this fascinating. I think the political horse trading is a really interesting thing. But move on, because a lot happened this week. Not one, but two Boeing 787s were grounded, not for batteries. Yesterday, there was another one, not for batteries. One had a oil tank problem, and the other one had some other as yet really an undetermined problem. But it that was sort of interesting news as Boeing announced from the Paris Air Show that it had sold some of the next version of this airplane. And then the sort of underpinning uneasiness under all of that is like, who's going to build these planes and where is that going to happen?
Well, they were selling like hotcakes. I mean, a lot of planes were selling. I think that's one thing that we were very fixated on, the competition between Boeing and Airbus. But I didn't see anybody say, wow, a lot of airplanes were sold. So another indicator of the economic change that has happened. It is unclear where the 787-10 will have final assembly. There seems to be quite a dance going on about that right now. And so that was a very interesting, you know, these folks are in Paris, but they talk to each other. That's why you get so much aviation news, because they keep seeing each other at the same event. And that was one of the things that was left hanging.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought was interesting this week in terms of the Boeing-Airbus rivalry, we've been so used in Washington to cheering for Boeing and its success and Airbus's failure. But then there was news that Airbus might be moving work and creating jobs in Washington State. And, wow, people just turned right around.
Well, jobs are jobs.
Exactly. And it's actually surprising that no one really thought of that before. It might be better for the state to play the two aerospace giants off against each other rather than putting all of our eggs in one basket.
All right. So, Knut, son of Boeing, or aren't you a son of Boeing?
No.
Yeah. I thought your dad worked for Boeing. No, nope. Neighborhood nope. of Boeing.
Oh, yeah.
You had something that you wanted to say about
all
this.
Well, yeah, there are kind of two things. One, the overall economic picture. Seattle got good news with a low unemployment rate. The state, it's still fairly high, but there's progress here in Seattle. You see the construction cranes and lots of Boeing planes are selling. And then it's all leavened by these cautions that are coming through as Boeing looks at relocating or doing more airplane work in South Carolina. It's all and what's being set up here is another big negotiation with the state over benefits for Boeing, in other words. And so they're playing the states off of one another, and I think Eli's exactly right about playing, you know, we need to get better at playing that game. You have to be very careful about it, but because no one wants to be the person that like loses Boeing. But they've been very clear that their long-term loyalty is very situational.
It's this fascinating kind of push-pull between the fact that Boeing wants to diversify the areas in which it builds planes, assembles planes, does all these different things, and sort of not talking so much about the workforce here, which is what Airbus comes in and says, wait a minute, you have this workforce there that we would be attracted to, even though you don't think of us as a company that would do anything in Washington State.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you cannot pass laws, the tax breaks and subsidies for specific companies, but you can for an industry. Hmm. And so when Boeing got its last huge benefits package during the Locke administration to help keep them in Everett and keep them happy, you know, that legislation was written in such a way that any aerospace company could take advantage of that. And I wrote actually a column at the time saying, let's get Airbus. Let's bring those guys here. Let's take the state at its word that this is about an industry, not about a specific company. Everybody, of course, knows it's not about the industry. It is about a specific company. Wink, wink, nod, nod. But
it could be about an industry.
But it could be. And I think strategically you have to find a way to continue to evolve us out of the mindset that we lose everything if we lose Boeing, because frankly, we're going to lose them or a big chunk of them at some point.
Right.
And we have to diversify.
The Airbus jobs were engineering jobs, am I right?
They were talking about opening an engineering center and doing some work with some of the suppliers. So that's what that story said. And I was remembering, I didn't remember the column, I apologize, but I was remembering when the Gary Locke era Boeing improvements came in. It did seem at that time to me that it was all about Boeing, because I remember being at an event where they just absolutely everyone got up and applauded Gary Locke for having done this, the business community. Mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting.
Right. And Airbus has been positioned here as the kind of evil rival of Boeing for the tanker project. Now they're saying they think they may have an opportunity to come back at getting some of that tanker business. It's interesting.
And we've seen something similar happen in the tech industry, where Microsoft and the tax breaks that it gets and the advantages in the state that it has and the worker base that it's helped develop then made the place inviting for Google, which moved up here and has opened a couple offices in Facebook also.
And now will be a tech center as well as a biotech center as well as an aerospace center. And that is why our unemployment is below 4%.
Although there was that poll that also said, 70% of Americans are...
hate their jobs.
Yeah.
Are disengaged. It didn't
disengaged,
say
going through the motions and mad at their boss.
Yep.
How about that?
It's a lot of people. We're talking.
I'm self-employed and I feel that way.
Takes some work, you know.
Knut Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders are here. Our environmental reporter, Ashley Ahern, went nuts the other day when the Army Corps of Engineers told a congressional subcommittee that it wasn't going to consider climate change when it came to making its decision about coal export terminals. It didn't only excite her. Apparently, they didn't bother to tell state officials about this decision before they testified to Congress about it.
You mean Mike McGinn?
I mean Department of Ecology and the governor.
I mean,
Mike McGinn's a city official. He didn't know about it either.
But he was there testifying.
Right. So he heard it first.
His experience before that committee back in Congress was just... Did anybody watch the video?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Why don't you describe it for listeners who did not have that pleasure?
Okay, so the video is Mike McGinn going back, and he had some earlier written testimony that he'd given to this committee. And there was one of the members of the committee was from West Virginia, which, as everybody knows, is a coal, very active coal-producing state. And this gentleman, McKinley, I don't have his first name, Representative McKinley, was all over Mike McGinn. And he said it, you know, gave him shivers that Mike McGinn had said that coal was something that was best left in the ground. And this guy was just all over him about this. And so then as Mike McGinn, in that sort of lawyerly voice that he has sometimes, he even had glasses that I had never seen on in the video, was trying to explain real calmly, soft voice, yes, this is something I believe. He's, you know, obviously against the coal plants that would be coming here. So McKinley at this point turns on him and says, you know, if you're so busy about coal, you should take a look at the Seattle crime rate. And it was like this huge non sequitur, like, what? And McGinn was trying, but I'll tell you about my crime rate. And the funniest thing is last night the Seattle Police Department was tweeting the crime rate because he couldn't get it out before this committee. The guy wouldn't let him finish his sentence, that the crime rate in Seattle is actually doing pretty well. But this guy was just like, neat, neat, neat. He was just all over him.
Well, and one of the other committee members remarked on that like radical U-turn that the congressman took and said, this is the first time we've been talking about crime rates in the coal subcommittee.
This particular subcommittee was not, it's essentially how do we move our energy sources from place to place. So it was specifically, those are the kind of people that are on the panel. They're not necessarily opposed to coal and liquid natural gas, I believe, was the other substance that they were hearing about.
Yeah, well, this guy was obviously standing up for his piece of the resource economy. And I know the wood guys probably didn't like the coal guys, and the coal guys didn't like the oil guys. And I mean, there's always, technology moves on. The oil guys don't like the solar or wind guys. There's always a thing here. And I mean, the shameful thing kind of about that exchange, I mean, it was amusing, was just that he was trying to discredit Mike McGinn's very existence being there in front of Congress, as if he didn't have a right to testify on an issue that's incredibly relevant to the people of Seattle. So Yeah, if I were Mike McGinn, I'd want everybody to see that video.
It was a good video in terms of McGinn's forcefulness on climate change, and that was another shameful thing about the – it was really testimony from this congressman. He basically denied the reality of climate change, and what really seemed to get him, what he was most aghast about, was that Mike McGinn had said in his letter that we should leave this coal in the ground where it belongs, and he just could not fathom that possibility. But you see in that that this – same kind of conflict that is, you know, going on between the state of Montana, which wants to get that coal out of the ground, or at least a lot of people there do to make money, and the other states along the coal route that McGinn was out there testifying about that are more concerned about global warming.
And then Representative McKinley went on to say that he was talking about the idea that, you know, yeah, there's climate change. But then he sort of opened up the whole thing. We don't know if it's man-made. We don't know if it's just a naturally recurring. And so these two gentlemen could not have been further apart on this very important topic. So
the interesting thing, I saw a quote this week, and I'm sorry that I can't name the energy executive who said it, but it was somebody who builds coal plants, who said the best coal plant is one that we don't have to build. In other words, even people in coal, in the coal industry, are realizing that they that conservation and other forms of energy are kind of in the future.
Hans emails on the subject of coal. So with all this coal furor this week, State Senator Doug Erickson, who's a Republican leader, wants to close the Department of Ecology's Bellingham office to save money. Issues like this kind of make it seem that the ecology office should stay open in Bellingham.
Yes, even after the shutdown or something like that.
State shutdown, yeah.
I just want to make one other comment about the Army Corps of Engineers, who is an organization with kind of a mind of its own and often crosses swords with other branches of government and whatnot over what it can do and what it wants to do. But when you're doing any big federal environmental project and you do an EIS, the whole ball game comes down to the people who get to do the EIS get to make the rules. They get to decide what the scope of it is. And you can see that in the coal debate, the coal train debate, people who are most skeptical about the coal trains want a broad study. Mm-hmm. People who are supportive want to limit it just to, well, what's its impact going to be on Bellingham or on a specific, specific issue? And I think Jay Inslee and the mayor have, you know, a very strong case to make that the environmental impact study needs to be much broader than that in terms of, or, you know, the study of the impact on the small towns, on coal dust, on these other issues. Those kinds of studies are very complicated, difficult to do, and often very unfavorable to projects that the government or anybody else wants to support.
And in this heated debate, one takes shorter time and one takes longer time, and that's maybe what some folks are looking for.
But what Jay Inslee, I talked to him right after this came out, and what he said was essentially, well, the state has a parallel review process when it comes to these coal terminals. And he didn't say, when I asked him whether the state could overrule the Army Corps' siting decision, he didn't answer that directly, but he implied that Washington State could certainly tie things up for quite some time.
That's right. The Commissioner of Public Lands in particular, I think, has some serious roadblocks that he could throw in the way of these proposals. So you're absolutely right. If the Army Corps of Engineers makes this easy for the coal companies, the state can make it hard.
We're talking over the week's news with Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knute Berger. I'm Marcy Silman. We'll be back after a break here on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Teatro Zinzani's new show, Lucky in Love. Proprietress Ruby is betting her casino could hit the big time in this show, featuring an international cast of comedians, clowns, and acrobats, served with a multi-course dinner. Now through September 8th. Tickets at zinzani.org.
I'm Warman Olney. On To The Point, factory farms raise thousands of pigs, cattle, or poultry all in the same place. They're efficient, but the EPA says runoff pours pathogens and toxic metals into rivers and streams. Are factory farms part of America's future? Can they be operated without polluting the water? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
That's just about 20 minutes from now this morning at 11 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and the Shoreline Lake Forest Park Arts Council present the 23rd Shoreline Arts Festival, celebrating the creativity of artists and diverse cultures on June 29th and 30th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
57 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Chance of showers through the day, and we expect to reach 65 this afternoon. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1041.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman, and our panel of journalists is here, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. This week, interesting, a little squib in the Seattle newspaper, Seattle Police Officer Guild newspaper, The Guardian. Rich O'Neill, it's hard for me to spit that all out. Rich O'Neill wrote a column urging his membership to drop their ongoing objections to the police reform process. Your reporter, Seattle Times reporter Steve Miletich, picked that up. And it's an about face for O'Neill.
It is. And, as I was reading it, I was sort of holding my breath because I thought I knew the reason, but I didn't get to what may be the reason till about a couple of paragraphs down. Two things. He had a very convincing meeting with Merrick Bobb, who's doing some of the work on the federal oversight. I keep wanting to change his name to Bob Merrick. I'm
it's not
sorry
Bob
about
Merrick,
that.
It's Merrick Bobb.
Just want to. But anyway, moving right along. Also, and this was after holding my breath for a period of time, got to the point that there is a debate right now over the head of the Police Guild's salary and benefits, and who will continue to pay them. The city currently pays those. And it is debatable at this moment if they will continue to in the long term. And so it was very, because I was reading, I was going, okay, so I know the reason for this. You know, he's worried that if he keeps sort of denying what's in front of him on changes to the police department, that the city will maybe not continue that.
Yeah, it was one of the issues in their contract negotiations, and it isn't settled. Which is kind of interesting. So you're saying it was a total self-serving move.
Well, I'm not saying that because they also mentioned in the same story that he'd had this very important turnaround type meeting with Merrick Bobb that convinced them that he must go forward. So it did seem two-pronged, to be fair to that.
The total self-serving move fits with what we know about Rich O'Neill so far. So on that theory, it kind of meshes with his public persona at least. And it remains bizarre that the state or that the city pays his salary.
It does remain bizarre. I actually read his column. I went back and read it, and it was not just Merrick Bobb that was at this meeting. It was also Jim Pugel, who Steve Miletich says also opposed the reform process, and there was some kind of come to Jesus meeting somewhere along the line where everyone decided, well, hey, it's this isn't in any of our interests. I don't know. That's giving them a lot of benefit of a doubt. Roll over.
I didn't read the entire column, but I read some of the excerpts of it and was interested in. Part of it is, look, we don't make the policy. We enforce. We're law enforcement. So if they want us to do something from a policy standpoint, we need to get on board with that. I mean, that's just kind of basic and sending that message out to the rank and file. There's a history of provocative columns in that newspaper or newsletter. And the one part that got me was the way he was explaining it, which was basically to say, hey, if we all worked at McDonald's and they told us instead of putting four pickles on your hamburger, we're supposed to put two pickles on the hamburger, even though we know four pickles taste better, you got to put the two pickles on the hamburger. And I thought, well, OK, one, that's making it simple, I guess. And then the other is, we're talking about killing people here. We're not talking about pickles. I mean, it just had this way of kind of dismissing, sort of saying, yeah, we're going to go along, but we think the whole thing is BS. And, that still is in there. And so when you're talking about cultural change or transformation, no real sign of that, although you can't say that this isn't maybe a little bit of progress.
But the pickle rule, just to take it on its face
here,
also suggests that if you work somewhere, you eventually have to follow the changes that are coming to that institution. And, so for a while you're going to put too few pickles or too many pickles, but you're going to finally step in line, right?
We talked a lot in this panel about the impact of police reform and the public safety issue on the mayoral primary, which is now less than 2 months away. So does this change anything, this little squib from Rich O'Neill?
Maybe. Maybe Mike McGinn. Honestly, I'm not sure how many people outside of this panel follow what Rich O'Neill is saying. But it is a...
Hopefully his rank and file do.
Maybe, if they can parse the pickle analogies. But I think maybe Mike McGinn can use this to say, see, I'm bringing the police union, the really intransigent police union along, and that's not easy. And so he can use that to deflect some of the criticism about how he's handled police reform.
They've taken a stand against excessive use of pickles.
Anything changed this week? There were a couple other mayoral get-togethers.
You know, if you look at their schedule, they're together almost every night. Or
yes, it seems
four
so.
Four or five times. And the one that you guys aired had the book reading, which sort of...
Your favorite passages.
Your favorite passages. And that I found sort of interesting because you had the controversy erupting over Peter Steinbuch's reading of his passage. And people reacted badly because he waded into sort of rough territory there. He was doing an excerpt from a book that had someone speaking in an African-American dialect,
yes,
which is risky if you're going to do it. And so it really, it got a lot of news is all I'm remarking here.
I'm going to try to find the transcript so I can read it to you because I can't recite it offhand.
Well, the transcript won't do it justice. It's
the reading
it's his reading of it.
Of the book.
Were any of you at that? Were you at that?
No, but we posted on the slog, I think yesterday, video of the reading. And I think it had a marker as to the time when Peter Steinbuch starts reading. So you might be able to find it that way. Certainly you can find the whole video on the slog. We also, at The Stranger, did a sort of cheat sheet to the mayoral race so far.
A tongue-in-cheek cheat sheet.
It's yes, and very useful as well. It kind of gets to what we see as the core of their personalities and comes with some handy illustrations so that if you're choosing based on looks, you can do that too.
Well, entertaining. Useful, I'm not sure I'd agree with that, but entertaining.
I think you were dissed personally, Knut, in that.
Subset of a plural.
I didn't take that as a diss.
Oh, okay.
It said that
mossbacks,
some of the people,
certain...
among people who are attracted to Peter Steinbuch are mossbacks, lowercase.
Plural. And plural.
Plural.
Yeah.
So I'm just glad to know there's more than one. So
you have numbers. You didn't know that it was a movement, the mossback movement. Will all three Crosscut, The Stranger, and The Times endorse before this primary?
As far as
I know, yeah, sure.
When will that happen?
I mean, the
timings are also different now that everything's mail in. You have to do that months in advance.
Things have to go earlier, that's for sure, because, you know, I don't know if you've all noticed this, but as these elections go, especially since the summer, the primary is so early in the summer now, so the ballots go out in like the middle of July or something like
weeks.
That. And so, you know, it does feel like, you know, once the ballots go out, that there's like a lot of them go back in. And then it's almost like there's this quiet time. And people aren't, you know, there's like this lull before you find out who won. So you have to go early.
A lull could last forever. Could be months.
Oh, I point out that Crosscut also has its very useful cheat sheet on the candidates with illustrations and backgrounds.
Well, you've had
stuff.
We have a
special kind of webpage called The Hunger Games. You could click on a tile and go to all of our mayoral coverage. We've been doing a lot.
We've been doing individual
we
interviews.
We do not do endorsements. So we interview all the candidates.
You don't do any endorsements?
We're a nonprofit. We can't.
Uh-huh.
We can't step into that, you know.
Okay, so for-profit people. I'm curious about the process of endorsements, especially when there's nine candidates. This primary is sort of nutty. So is it, you know, does everybody come in with a drink and you draw lots, or, you know, how does
Isn't
it
that
work?
How The Stranger
the
does
drink
it?
Part is pretty accurate.
That's for you guys.
Stranger, not for the Seattle Times.
No drinks at the Seattle Times?
A lot of water being.
Yeah. Well, so do you fight about it? How does it work? What happens?
When I was on the editorial page, sure, yes. We would, you know, listen to all of them, question them pretty intensely, and have a debate royale.
And does the publisher get to trump everything?
He gets to speak, that's for darn sure.
Yeah, at The Stranger Too, is it the publisher's view?
Well, he gets a vote.
A vote?
Yeah, and so do all the members of this, we call it the Stranger Election Control Board.
Are you on that?
I have been, and I think I will be maybe for one of the races this year. I haven't been able to make the endorsement meetings that we've been having so far. So as to the question of process, The Stranger has been having just a parade of candidates in, the people who are running for school board, the people who are running for King County Council, all of those lower races. That it's actually a very, very useful service for us to get into them because people don't have the time. And then we'll be having the mayors in, I think, next Friday. And as you were asking about the timing of the endorsement issue, we always time it for when the ballots arrive in your mailbox. So if you see a ballot come, pick up a copy of The Stranger or go online and our endorsement issue will be up.
And what races, aside from the mayoral race, are going to be on this primary?
Well, there's some city council races that will be on also, and they're not getting a lot of publicity, but they're out there. The city attorney is on the ballot, but unopposed.
Unopposed. Yes.
Oh, okay. So maybe it's not.
So yeah. It's only where there's.
That's right. More
only where there's a more challenge, because
yeah,
you do
right.
appear on the general election, because even if
that's right.
there isn't anybody there.
So there's nobody running against Pete Holmes.
As far as I know.
And that's it. There's no time to enter your name.
Oh, it's
over.
It's way too late for that.
The filing deadline passed a long time ago.
Wow. And how many of the city council races are challenged? Do you guys
there
know?
Are about two or three are have challengers.
Dow Constantine has challengers, but they're not really going anywhere.
There's a King County Council seat that will have some activity in it, the Julia Patterson seat.
You know, it's interesting. I know this is as early as we're going to get with this. With this primary, right? It can't go any
further. It's not going any further unless it goes. You know, there was talk for years of having the primary move to June so that it wouldn't be smack in the middle of the summer. The reason it had been moved back from September, you'll recall, was that with really close races, it's very hard to process
right.
from late September, which is when it was, to November. So they started moving it back into August as recommended by the Secretary of State.
And, you know, it's always fun to have an election when it's incredibly beautiful outside. But now it doesn't matter because you're, doing this at breakfast or maybe with a drink like the people at The Stranger.
Or taking your ballot to the beach and looking on your phone at the endorsement cheat sheet that we put up. I mean, one of the nice things about mail-in balloting is that you can do it from anywhere, from the bar, as you were suggesting.
I still miss the going into a polling place.
I
sorry,
do too.
I'm a Luddite. Well, while we're speaking of intoxicants, pot licensing officials are trying to get everybody ready for issuing the marijuana licenses, and it's not all going as smoothly as they might have hoped.
Well, they put out, what was it, 10 tips
for getting a license? Top 10 suggestions for getting, that's what it's called.
And tip number two was get a lawyer. So that's an indication that things are complex.
It's complex, and there still seems to be some debate over whether the Liquor Control Board should be in charge of pot at all.
Well, we're starting a new industry here that's going to have pretty heavy government regulation. And so that's why they took so much time in the original drafting of the initiative to let it, because they knew the process was going to be so complicated and so controversial. So, for example, one of the things that I saw was what would be the symbol
right.
For pot and I think other products grown in this state. And so one rendering, the one I saw, had the state of Washington and this, is it seven?
The leaf.
The leaf that was on it. And so then became a debate over, is that the state endorsing for your kids in some way the use of such a product? So, you know, they knew this would be fraught with different reactions to fairly basic stuff.
Well, it's interesting because, there's the issue of what the what you have to do in order to apply for the license,
mm-hmm.
To get one of the licenses. And then there's the whole thing about the rules themselves and the debate over all the specifics. What is a farm?
Mm-hmm.
How do you define farm? How do you define a school or daycare, which grow operations can't be near? There's discussion about whether you should grow everything indoors or grow it
outdoors. Well, I think they finally relinquished because it was all supposed to be in a hard-sided roofed structure, and now they've determined that sunshine uses less fossil fuel, so it's actually ecologically better to grow your marijuana out in a field.
But although there was a controversy about that. Does that give children access? You know, easy, just, oh, I walked by and I saw these pot plants and I thought I'd help myself.
And there's an interesting article in the New York Times today about the experience in California where growing pot in forests is disrupting the ecosystems there, waste washing into streams that salmon live in, and so on.
I think in California, though, the pot growers are going out surreptitiously into these forests.
So that was a good point in the story, that the problem there is exacerbated by murky laws, and here we're hopefully going to have very clear laws. Another little facet of that quickly was the congressional delegation going to D.C. this week to say, hey, Attorney General Eric Holder, make clear whether the federal government is going to step in on this or not so that we can move forward.
Which they haven't been so speedy in Washington, D.C., either for here or for Colorado. You had something you wanted to say.
Well, I was just going to make that point that despite all the specifics and arguments over all the details, and of course there's also concern over will big corporations take over all the pot, where's the little guy and all that. But the big over unanswered question is it's illegal according to federal law.
It is indeed.
And so when are the feds going to say something? And do you want them to say something? And when do you want them to say? Because businesses obviously like predictability. They don't want to start a business and then find themselves in a federal penitentiary for something.
No.
On the other hand, there are periods of ambiguity when a new industry is being born that can actually be an advantage. And so, a maybe is better than a no.
That's the case for them not saying.
Right, exactly.
Yet.
Now, before I let you guys go, I have to ask you this question, because on Monday we're going to do a segment about personal theme songs. We were watching something recently. Somebody came through here and we thought, this is his theme song. And so we want to know, listeners, this applies to you, what's your personal theme song? When you walk into a room, what song plays? You know, like at the Mariners game where every Mariner has a song. Eli's looking at me aghast. We want you to call the voicemail, 206-685-2526, 206-685-2526, or you can email us. But Joni, quick, what's your song?
Well, I have to say to you, Marcy, quick, what's your song? Because you've had more time to think about
it. I said it was Clouds. I've looked at life from both sides now, and they told me that was too depressing, so I'm going to have to come up with something.
How about You Are My Sunshine?
That's it. Depends on the day.
Well, if I had to choose right now, there was a great old song by the Northwest rock band, the Sonics, called Boss Hoss. He's a real boss hoss. I would want that to play.
I don't have a personal theme song, but I have a song of the summer at the moment. There's a group called Phosphorescent. They've got a song called, I think it's Ride On, Ride On. But it's a good summer driving song. We're taking a long trip out to Montana.
And so you're going to play that?
I'm going to play that.
And we'll play that for you. Nothing for Joni. All right, next week.
I'm thinking of it.
You'll have to say it next week. Joni Balter, assistant political editor at the Seattle Times. Knute Berger, the Moss Bag at crosscut.com. Eli Sanders, riding on, associate editor at The Stranger. And I'm looking at life from both sides now. I'm Marcy Silman. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Alsadi. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. He's going to pick his song. I'm Marcy Silman. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here with your theme songs on Monday here on KUOW.
Awesome.
Here's an old theme song you may remember. The Pink Panther just walked into the room.
Excellent.
It's 10:59. Today, President Obama is expected to nominate James Comey as FBI director. That and more of today's news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
I'm Brooke Gladstone. On this week's On the Media, a new bill hopes to set limits on...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.